Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, information about the coronavirus seems to spread as fast as the virus itself. Sometimes it is just too much information, an overload. Some people even spread misinformation on purpose. How can you separate what is true and what is not? Along with facts about the new coronavirus, untrue rumors are spreading through phone texts, social media, and other places. For example, in the United States, a rumor has been spreading that officials plan to order a nationwide lockdown. Not true. Another rumor claims that people can get tested for the virus by donating their blood. And the U.S. government has sent warning letters to several companies selling products that they claim will cure COVID-19 or protect against the virus. Such false stories can endanger public health and create fear. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the virus. Thousands across the world have been affected by it. In most infected people, COVID-19 produces minor or moderate effects, like an increased temperature and dry cough. Some people might also experience tiredness and pain. Most people recover from the sickness within 2 weeks. But for older adults and people with other health problems, the disease can be severe, sometimes even deadly. How can you separate fact from fiction? How can you know what is true and what is false? Here are some ways. Human nature makes us more likely to believe things our friends tell us. It is why rumors spread and why misinformation travels on social media. Everyone says they heard it from a friend of a friend who knows someone who knows about an issue. Be suspicious of important-sounding information if it does not come from a respected source connected to the issue. Usually, dependable sources include government agencies and health departments. Other organizations to trust include national and international public health institutes, such as the World Health Organization. Some of the most trusted sources of information include research hospitals and public health centers in the United States and other countries, along with the World Health Organization. They provide the latest numbers, advisories, and guides on everything from how to clean your home to remove the virus and how to deal with stress the pandemic is causing. Dr. Jessica Justman is an infectious disease expert at Columbia University. It's not just misinformation, it's also a lack of good information, Justman said. Go straight to the source. The CDC has been putting out great information. John Silva is Director of Education at the News Literacy Project, a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. He says anyone searching for true information needs to act a little like a reporter by investigating suspect claims. Be careful of information from unknown or little-known groups or news organizations. Also, remember there is a difference between news stories and opinion pieces, but both should be supported by evidence or expertise to be dependable. A 2018 Twitter study by Massachusetts Institute of Technology researchers found that false news travels faster than real news, often much faster. That is because these stories often use language designed to create strong emotional reaction. The stories seek to connect with public fears or anger. The researchers also found that misinformation spreads quickly because people retweet stories based on headlines. So read the whole story, investigate the source, and consider carefully before reposting to prevent the spread of false information. Pictures are said to be worth 1,000 words, but even photographs and videos can be edited and changed. Even untouched images can be false. For example, old images can be presented as new. Again, it helps to look for the source. Google's reverse image search can help find where a photo came from. For videos, investigate the post source. Was it a traditional news organization, the WHO, a university? Dr. Ruth Parker is a physician at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. She said, Americans must be responsible in spreading information. It's a scary time, Parker said. We don't want to add fuel to the fire. Good information won't cure us, but it will help to calm us.
As schools close because of the coronavirus outbreak, educators in specialized subjects are dealing with the difficulty of moving their classes online. College classes in the sciences and arts often use laboratory work, performances, or even travel to teach students important lessons. Some of these classes require special equipment or the ability to gather in a group. For example, what does an engineering lab course look like online? How does a musical group practice? VOA Learning English spoke to educators across the United States recently. Some described the difficulty of moving classes online in economic or technical terms. Tom Luer is a music professor at California State Polytechnic University, Pomona. He noted that his school has many students who do not have some kinds of technology or special equipment at their homes. Lectures, reading assignments, and class discussions are not too difficult to deal with, Luer explained. But some kinds of lessons and performances are more difficult to do. Other educators were less concerned about technical problems and were more concerned about the overall goals for their classes. Aaron Sekulich is an engineering professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. He was going to lead a group of students on a project-based class in Armenia. The students, each working with local nonprofit organizations, were going to help develop solutions to problems facing their partners in Armenia. The students had spent months preparing for the project. The trip was canceled, but the project-based class is continuing online. For now, Sukulich has worked hard to find possible U.S.-based partners to work with. He hopes students can still do interviews and research using apps such as Zoom. "My primary concern has been how to keep the students motivated," Sukulich said. Barbara Oakley is a professor of engineering at Oakland University and Coursera's inaugural innovation instructor. Oakley believes that the main goal for teachers is to transfer their skills. In other words, teachers used to working in a class will have to test their teaching skills in a new way. Oakley strongly supports online education, but she said that high-level, specialized kinds of study, such as lab work in engineering, is not easy to move online. She was quick to add that there is no simple answer for how to teach specialized subjects. Although there are many problems, educators also see opportunities or bright spots in the sudden move to online education. Luer, at Cal Poly Pomona, looks forward to trying new teaching methods. He wants to use different computer applications to work with his music students. For example, one app, Acapella, lets musicians in different places record different parts of a piece of music. Then, the app helps students put the different parts together to create a single music track. Even if students do not have computers or special recording equipment, they can still record simple sound files on their phones. Oakley noted the importance of creativity in the move to online education. In the field of engineering, she said, some of the best lab-based courses that she has seen teach important scientific ideas rather than specific lab work.
Instead of perhaps going into some of the nuances of that particular lab, they'll go into the nuances of what good science actually involves. And if you're doing good research, what does that involve? How can good research become bad research, and how can you avoid that? These are very important topics, but they're often not covered in lab courses.
Matt Otto has been involved in online education for more than 10 years. Otto is a music professor at the University of Kansas. He believes that schools and educators will be able to find a way forward within a month or so. "Most teachers are problem solvers. That's what teaching is," he said. Otto said that online education cannot always recreate the exact social environment of a college campus. He noted, however, that he has seen many online students have great success. "People who think it's not a good method of teaching," he said, "maybe haven't done it, because I've seen the outcomes." One student, José Migueles, studied online with Otto over a period of 6 years.
"One of my other students from Spain went from being a hobbyist to being not only a professional, but he's got a position in university and got the Jazz Album of the Year in Spain this last year in 2019.
Otto said that he has seen many other students succeed while studying online. "I think that is a testament to how effective online teaching is," he said. I'm John Russell. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing, Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a Third World War. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them the Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane, I'll wiggle the wings, and then you know, that's me, watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Lindenbaum. I came back the next day and I put little parachutes for the Galgumi and the Schokoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hand and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow, they were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
VOA News. Via remote, I'm